This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, this is Commander Chris Hadfield. I'm an astronaut.
Attention all stations. Space Odyssey now commencing. Good afternoon, I'm Jimin B, and this is Careers Unusual, where we speak to people with jobs that are off the beaten path. Have you ever wondered what astronauts eat or whether it's possible to cry in space? Colonel Chris Hadfield spent decades in astronaut training and has logged nearly 4,000 hours in space.
When I was outside on a spacewalk, in the darkness, with all of the lights shut off, and we went through the aurora, we went through the southern lights, so they were pouring by all around me, between my legs and all around the ship, in all of the colors and the greens and reds and yellows and purples of the southern lights. That may be the most remarkable thing, but it's a pretty long list to choose from.
You lived in the International Space Station for about half a year. How is life different in space and on Earth?
The reason we have a space station is it's a huge laboratory. We run about 200 experiments on board. So it's as if your life was inside a laboratory, which is different because you are not only running all the experiments, but you're also the rat. You're the test subject. You're the guinea pig. So you're drawing blood and saliva and everything that your body produces and constantly being tested. So if you could imagine your life where you never left the laboratory, but also where no matter what broke, you had to fix it. You're also like the superintendent of the building and the maintenance technician and the phone company and the sewer company and the plumber and the computer company. And you're also the hospital and the doctors. So if anybody gets sick or breaks a tooth or has any problem, we have to take care of there's nobody else to take care of us, just the six of us that are up there. And then you're in communication with all of the mission controls around the world, the one in Japan and the one in Russia and Germany and Montreal and Houston. So you're constantly talking to the world. And then it seems like every day somebody important on Earth wants to talk to you. So you're speaking to the Prime Minister of Canada or the Queen or or the Sheikh or the whatever, the President. So there's all of that going on. So it's an extremely busy and demanding life. And meanwhile, you're weightless. So it's magic.
Yeah.
So it's like you're Superman. And you go around the world every 92 minutes. So yep. You see the whole world. You go around the world 16 times a day. So, I mean, you cross Africa in 4 minutes, you know. So you cross all of North America in 8 minutes. So you get to know the whole world like your own backyard. So it's an intoxicatingly addictive place to be. It's a magnificent new human experience. And also, the last thing that's different from life on Earth maybe is that it's extremely dangerous. At any given second, you may, if the meteorite pops through the wall or if the atmosphere is contaminated or if there's a fire, then you have to abandon ship immediately. And then there's no one to take care of you. You are the ones who then have to fly yourselves home in your Soyuz. So there's always that undercurrent of seriousness and danger to what you're doing. So it's a very measured and deliberate and rich existence.
Hadfield flown two space shuttle missions, served as commander of the International Space Station, and made history as the first Canadian to float in space.
Well, I've been involved in all of the space missions from 1992 until 2013. As an astronaut, you support all the other astronauts and you help. I worked in mission control for 25 shuttle flights. And so I was very much involved in all of the space program. But personally, I flew in space 3 times. I flew the space shuttle twice, not by myself, of course, but with a crew. And I flew as the pilot or the left-seater of the Soyuz, the Russian rocket, once. And then I helped build the Russian space station Mir, the early space station, which first launched in 1986. And then on my second flight, I did spacewalks to help build the International Space Station. And then on my third flight, I lived on the International Space Station for almost half a year and was the commander of what is really the world spaceship, the International Space Station. So all sorts of different jobs. I was also NASA's director of operations in Russia and chief of space station operations for NASA's astronaut program and chief of robotics and things like that. So all of those are involved with flying safely in space.
What about the experience of your first spacewalk? I understand that it was quite a nerve-wracking one.
It's extremely dangerous to do a spacewalk, and we don't do them recreationally. We do spacewalks only when we have to, where we need human dexterity or human judgment and cleverness outside. Otherwise, we'd prefer not to go outside because of the risk. But during my second spaceflight, we were docked with the International Space Station using Space Shuttle Endeavour. And myself and one other astronaut put on the huge white spacesuits twice, in fact, on two different spacewalks and went outside for a total of about 15 hours outside. And since we go around the world every hour and a half, that means I was out, went around the world 10 times while I was outside. A huge amount of work. And years and years and years of training and preparation. And all sorts of stuff was demanding while we were out there. All sorts of the equipment malfunctions, and it's an extremely harsh environment. And then also for a while I was outside, there was contamination in my suit, which blinded me for about a half hour during my first spacewalk while I was outside. So, but you say whether it was nerve-wracking. Just because something happens doesn't mean necessarily your nerves have to be racked. It kind of depends how ready you are for things or not. And even though we faced all sorts of difficulties, the reason I mentioned all the training, after all that preparation, it wasn't nearly as nerve-wracking as it might have been if I hadn't been ready. But what astronauts basically do is spend their lives getting ready for things to go wrong, so that when it happens, we can deal with it without being overwhelmed. So even though I was blind outside holding onto a spaceship, it was just a thing to deal with. It wasn't incapacitating. It wasn't scary. It was just an increased risk and a problem to solve. And fortunately, we solved the problem. And my eyes eventually cleared. And I could finish the rest of the spacewalk. And we got everything done. And it turned out to be just the chemical that we used to keep the visor clear, to keep it from fogging up. Just that chemical is what contaminated my eyes. And since then, we've changed it to be a much more eyeball-friendly chemical so that other astronauts won't have the same problem.
I mean, it sounds like it's a really fun job to have, but certainly a very risky one. Like, what happens next is really uncontrollable as well. How do you manage that on a daily basis? How do you tell yourself that, okay, it's going to be okay, it's going to be another day of great discovery? How do you do that?
Well, what we don't do is cross our fingers and hope. What we do is we say, what is the most probable thing to go wrong? And then we figure out exactly what it would look like, what we can do about it. And then we practice over and over again. And then we figure out what is the second most probable thing and the third. And we do that for the 1,000 most probable things until we have them all sort of sorted out and practiced and drilled. So I was an astronaut for 21 years and I was only in space for 6 months. So the other 20 and a half years was trying to discover everything that might go wrong and then help develop all of the plans and procedures and then practice them so that they wouldn't just make us nervous, so we'd actually know what to do. Because the best antidote for nervousness is competence. And yes. So we try and become competent at everything all the time. And that's very much the life of an astronaut is anticipating things going wrong and then developing all of the knowledge and the skills so that they don't overwhelm you when they happen.
You definitely have to be an all-rounder.
It's really helpful, yeah.
Yeah.
Specialization is for insects. You know, we're human. And the more things you're capable of doing, the better crewmate you are.
That's
because
great.
The six of us up there, it's the last people on Earth. The
yeah.
six of us have to be able to take care of everything. So, you know, we do medical training. I trained as an emergency medical technician. And then I worked in a hospital in Houston in a bunch of different wards and on cadavers. And then I worked in the operating room. And then I worked in emergency as people came in off the street. And that was just in case somebody got sick so that I could do all the basic skills necessary. I'm not a doctor, but we need to have enough skills that we can be useful in case any of those probable events might occur. So it's just part of the life. It actually, it makes you comfortable and confident. Then you're not always worried about stuff because you've spent the time getting ready for the things that might happen. You're not all tensed up and nervous all the time.
The dream sparked when you were really young. If I understand, it was at 9 years old?
When they walked in the moon in July of 69, I was just about to turn 10. So yeah, the day that I decided to start turning myself into an astronaut, I was a little boy just about to turn 10 years old. The first thing that inspired me to be an astronaut was comic books when I was little, and science fiction stories and TV shows and movies, all the fantasy stuff. That was my original inspiration. But then it was the real people flying in space, the original ones with, you know, Yuri Gagarin and Al Shepard and John Glenn. But what really convinced me the day that I decided to become an astronaut was the day that the first two people walked on the moon, July 20th, 1969, when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. That is the day that I decided I wanted to turn myself into an astronaut.
So what is your background before reaching the stars?
Oh, I have a lot of different backgrounds. I grew up on a farm, so I'm a farmer. I was a downhill ski racer and a ski instructor. And then I went to universities. I went to four different universities and became an engineer, a mechanical and aerospace engineer. And then I joined the Air Force and was a pilot and then a fighter pilot. And then I went to test pilot school and became a test pilot. And so I guess I was a engineer, ski instructor, farmer, test pilot.
Interesting. So you seem to be in good pace to really achieving it, like earning a glider pilot scholarship at age 15 and then a powered pilot scholarship at age 16. Is it really detailed planning, or it was more like a surprise along the way, like whatever comes, come?
Nobody becomes anything worthwhile in life just waiting for whatever comes, come, I don't think. No Olympic athlete, no head of anything, no great researcher, and definitely no astronaut. If you just wait for random events to happen, then your life will probably end up randomly being something that you didn't really want or expect. But it might, but you never know. But in my case, no. I decided to be an astronaut when I was 9, and I got first flew in space when I was 35. So it took 26 years of work in order to become somebody who could be trusted to fly a spaceship. It was a lifetime of work.
It's been an interesting exploration with Chris Hadfield. But Houston, we have a problem because we need to take a short break. We'll be right back, and you're listening to Careers Unusual, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Careers Unusual with me, Jermaine B. Watching the Apollo 11 moon landing on TV as a child, Chris Hadfield actually lived up to all those dreams admiring Neil Armstrong. With his feet firmly planted on Earth now, Chris Hadfield continues to fire public enthusiasm for space discovery. Chris is a space auditee for becoming the most social media savvy astronaut ever, sharing his day-to-day activities out on Earth.
I've always used whatever media was available to try and let people know what we're doing and exploring the rest of the universe. And so on my first flight, the YouTube didn't exist. You know, it was before the internet, really, or at least before social media. But by my third space flight, Twitter existed and Facebook and simple ways, and we have good connectivity with the space station, sort of very primitive internet up there, so I could share the experience. And I spent a lot of time beforehand making videos during training. And when I launched for space, I think there were about, I don't know, 15 or 20,000 people following what I was doing. But now there are millions. And I think it's a reflection of the interest that people have in exploring the rest of the universe and what it's like and what astronauts do, what it means as a human being and what the Earth looks like. And so I did my absolute best to share it. I still do. It's why I'm talking to you today. And I shared it through photographs and words, and I made about 100 videos, and I wrote music and recorded a whole album of original music on the space station that I play with symphonies now. And I just wrote and recorded an album with a friend that we just did a debut of just very recently. And so hundreds of millions of people have seen those videos and heard those songs. And I think it's just a natural part of it. I think it shows that people aren't just interested in movies like The Martian or Interstellar, but they're also interested in actual space travel and what we're really doing on the spaceship. And it's just a natural extent. It's just a small part of an astronaut's job. No one's going to forgive you if you crash your spaceship. So that's your real job. But trying to share it, trying to let people see what goes on board, that's also part of the job. And yeah. So I just tried to take it seriously like everything else.
Okay, what about the misconceptions people have about astronauts?
People don't understand how much work it is. I basically worked at being an astronaut from the time I was 9 years old until I retired at 55 every day. It is an unending amount of work. It's an unforgiving job. It's a deathly job if you get it wrong. And it's not even a job. It's not like you're an astronaut from 9 to 5. It's not like, you know, you work in a bank or something. It is who you are for the rest of your life. You're an astronaut almost like a type of person. It's not just a job you had for a little while. So, and it's a life of service. Your personal desires take second place to the job the whole time. So you can never really plan a vacation or expect for sure to have time off. It's sort of like several jobs, you know, serving maybe in the military or maybe in the police or in the fire department or something. Your job has to take precedence. Your job is more pressing than your own personal desires. So I think most people's misperceptions are that you just sort of sit around and then suddenly you're going for a ride on a spaceship and then you're done. It's the opposite. It's decades of work for moments of spaceflight. And the real pleasure comes in the preparation and the planning and the invention and the support. And then occasionally there's a very small bit of icing on the cake of when you are actually the astronaut in space.
Can you share with us some of the values or life analogy that you hold dear?
Well, I've written 3 books about it. The first one's called An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, because that's all that really matters. I mean, it's nice what we do in space, but how it affects life on Earth, I think, is really important. And maybe one of the big analogies or crossover ideas, what's the difference between danger and fear? Because we often ask each other, you know, isn't flying a rocket ship scary? But I try and remind people that things aren't scary. People are scared. And just because something's happening, you don't have to be scared. It's like learning to ride a bicycle. At first, it's a little scary because you don't know what you're doing. But as soon as you've learned how to ride a bicycle, then the riding hasn't changed. The bicycle hasn't changed, but you no longer have to be afraid, even though the danger is exactly the same. And so I think you can treat everything in life that way. If you treated everything like you did, I wanted to learn how to ride a bicycle because it's freedom and it's speed and it's joy and it's the wind in your hair and the ability to travel. So you give yourself a goal and then you gain a skill until you become good at it so that you no longer are afraid of it. And now it's part of who you are and it enables you to do new things. You can do everything that way. And you've separated the danger from the fear. And yet, through a lot of life, you hear people say, oh, I could never do that. I'm afraid. And I think then you're sort of just giving yourself an excuse to deny yourself a whole portion of life. And you've hidden it behind the label of fear, as if fear and danger were the same thing. But they're not. Fear and danger are separate. It's really just up to us as to whether we're going to be afraid or not.
We know scientists have found a new solar system filled with planets that look like Earth and that, you know, it could support life. What do you think about that?
Yeah, we've found thousands and thousands of planets. The better the telescope, the more we can see. We used to think we were the center of the universe and that everything revolved around the Earth, because that's sort of what it looks like. But with every telescope we've built, we've discovered just how insignificant, or at least non-unique, Earth is. And very recently, as you say, in the Aquarius part of the sky, in the TRAPPIST system, around a fairly small little star, we have discovered seven planets, all of them, you know, roughly Earth-sized, and three of them just the right distance from that little sun so that they might be not too hot and not too cold, so that water could exist both as a liquid and as ice on the surface, just like on Earth. And maybe then there might be life on one of those planets. It's just a guess. We've never found life anywhere but Earth, but it's pretty thought-provoking to be able to see a system like that with so many rocky, Earth-like, Earth-sized planets. And we know that there are trillions and quadrillions and quintillions of planets out there, almost basically from our ability to understand, almost an infinite number of planets. So we haven't found any evidence yet, but it seems probable that there's life somewhere else. We don't know, but it's part of the reason we're exploring. Maybe we'll find life on Mars, or maybe on one of the moons of the other planets in our solar system, like on Ganymede or on Europa. Maybe we'll find life there. We just found life in northern Quebec from Earth from 4 billion years ago. So life developed on Earth really when the Earth was new, when the Earth was only half a billion years old. There's been life on Earth for 4 billion years. So it seems probable there's life somewhere else. We need to discover it before we'll know for sure. Until then, we're just looking. And that discovery out in the TRAPPIST system, it just continues to provoke our thought and to, I think, increase our desire to explore and therefore try and understand.
It's always interesting how, you know, there's always debate about the existence of aliens or UFOs. What is your thought about that one?
Well, there's no real debate. There's no evidence. So to debate something that has no evidence, it's just noise. I mean, you and I could have a debate as to whether shoes exist. But both of us know that shoes exist because there's evidence around us all the time. And both of us have shoes and we can hold up a shoe. But for us to debate something where there's no evidence is just an empty conversation. It's just speculation. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more important, rather than just debating it or to just have empty speculation, to actually go look and to search and to try and find evidence, because then we'll know. Okay. But just pretending and talking about it and hoping, and people say, do you believe in aliens? Which I think is a funny question. It's not a belief system. You know, It's like, I don't believe in shoes. I have evidence. I know a shoe exists. So it doesn't matter what I believe. What matters is, does it exist or not? And it's exactly the same question for life beyond Earth. We just haven't found any evidence of it yet. And there's lots of, you know, science fiction. And lots of hope, but it's really a matter of yes or no. And we don't know the answer yet. We haven't found any evidence. But that's part of the reason we have rovers driving around on Mars and a satellite going around Jupiter and another one going around Saturn, and why we're building a probe to go into the oceans of Europa. And who knows? We may find life right here in our own solar system, and then we'll know.
And would you have any space-related issues that we should be aware of here on Earth?
People take space travel almost for granted now. We all expect the fact that when you and I talk to each other on Skype, it's going to work perfectly. But we don't even think of how this is happening. Or if we pull out our GPS and we know where we are, or we listen to the weather forecast, or we watch, you know, a football game from another country, or all of the little subtle things that come as the direct product of space exploration, they're just part of the normal fabric of society now. And I think maybe it's worth recognizing that it's only 50 years old. Sputnik was in 57. So 60 years ago, this year was the very first satellite that ever got launched. And people have been in space a shorter time than I've been alive. When I was born, no one had ever flown in space. It's still a very new thing. And we now have had people living in space continuously for the last 16 and a half years. Our first crew started living on the International Space Station in the fall of 2000. So if you're someone who's 16 years of age or younger, you've never been alive when there weren't human beings living off of Earth. That's now part of our new normal. And it's pretty significant. 1,000 years from now, we'll look back on the year 2000 as the year we permanently left Earth. And there's a big step It's when we started becoming a multiplanetary species and giving ourselves a greater chance of survival. So I think we sort of, you know, we lose perspective sometimes in the day to day, and that's normal. But I think also it's worthwhile sometimes to step back, take a perspective, and recognize the magic of the things that we've invented. It's important for people to have a long-term, outrageous goal in life, something they would dream of doing, something that makes your heart go faster, something it just makes you smile when you think about it. Something that would, and not just, you know, randomness, not like winning the lottery where there's really nothing you can do to change your odds. I think something that you challenge yourself with and then start actually turning yourself into that person. Start making little corrections in yourself, little improvements in your own ability to do the things that you actually dream about. Because my goal is to walk on the moon. And I still haven't walked on the moon. But because I gave myself that outrageous goal, I became a pilot, a glider pilot, and a powered pilot. And I studied in university. And as I learned to speak Russian, and I've traveled the whole world. And I've flown in spaceships 3 times, none of which got me on the surface of the moon, but all of which were the daughter of that. And it's turned me into the adult that I am, and so many things that I love. And it's deliberate. Step by step, one small decision at a time. And I think it's those recognizing that it's the little small decisions in your life that turn you into who you want to be. That's worth thinking about, because we are all just the product of all the little small decisions we made every day.
It's been eye-opening talking to Chris. If you think this segment is too short, check out Chris Hadfield's YouTube, Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook page to catch his breathtaking space adventures and a good marvel on space science. You can also get a copy of his book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, available in Malaysia. If you missed part of this interview, don't sweat it. Head on down to our website, bfm.my, to download the podcast, or you can search for it on the BFM mobile app, available on the App Store and on Google Play. I'm Jermaine B, and this is Korea's Unusual BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.